Good evening and welcome to Editing Aloud. I have with me, as always, a panel of South Africa's best informed journalists on a day in which we've had news that the Seriti Commission on the Arms Deal has been essentially overthrown, Claudie Malevich, by the courts.
Yes, so the High Court in Pretoria today invalidated the findings of the Seriti Commission, which basically found that there was no corruption involved during the arms deal. So this is quite interesting in terms of what the implications it could be for President Jacob Zuma, who of course is doing his level best not to face graft charges as a result of the very same arms deal. So we would have to see, because he wouldn't be able to get away with it by just saying, well, the Seriti Commission didn't find anything, so, well, I shouldn't face anything.
Essentially, I think lots of people thought at the time that when the Seriti Commission on the Arms Deal reported its findings, that there was no corruption. That was basically a whitewash.
Yes.
Now a court has basically confirmed that it was a whitewash.
Well, yes, they basically, and like, pardon me if it's very basic, but they basically found that they didn't look into crucial evidence. And when Corruption Watch and Right to Know, Right to Know and Corruption Watch, when they brought the application to review it, they filed a supplementary affidavit quite recently in which they said they looked at the Rule 53 record and then said, well, look at how they have ignored certain things. And that is what, that's basically what has happened so far.
So does this open the way, help to open the way to a possibly successful prosecution of Jacob Zuma for the arms deal stuff, which really goes back 20 years almost?
Well, we would have to wait and see on that one. Of course, the court still hasn't delivered judgment on the stay of prosecution. And I assume that is the first step in the process, basically. So we'll have to wait and see on what the court judges in that or rules in that specific one before we can go any further as to even if he will face any charges.
Warren Thompson, the point's been made by some commentators that had we held the arms deal to account properly, maybe the sort of subsequent state capture would have been less facilitated, if you like. I mean, do you think that it was a sort of a defining moment almost that Seriti found that there was nothing wrong with the arms deal?
Absolutely. I think, and just to Claudie's point, it might not directly benefit Jacob Zuma's case, but it's one leg that's removed where he's lawyers are now unable to refer to any finding that found that the arms deal was legitimate and had been conducted in accordance with the lawful processes. But certainly I think many people have felt that was the point of departure for the ANC, which had held the moral high ground through the apartheid era, had inducted inaugurated a President Mandela that had begun to correct the wrongs of the previous regime, the government, and because it wasn't dealt with properly, it certainly opened the door to more perhaps egregious cases of corruption because it showed that the ANC was not prepared to self-regulate, and as a body and the ruling party, I think it's been dealt with by a couple of commentators who've said as much.
Tshisetso, does this give a signal for other commissions that will follow the court's ruling on Seriti?
Possibly, but I'm not sure if that will be successful because, I mean, this is an old scandal and people forget and evidence, you know, disappear or get lost. But, I mean, from where I stand, I think what it does more than anything, it throws the ball back into the NPA court as to what do you do with this now.
The question we're going to be asking Claudie about the findings of all these many commissions that have sat and are currently sitting. What's the NPA going to do about it?
Well, the NPA, like if you look at people such as Andrew Feinstein, has already tweeted and said, well, they would have to look at what happens to everybody that was completely exonerated by the Seriti Commission, of course. Yeah. But another interesting point of the court judgments today, I have absolutely no idea what the implication is when a commission of inquiry such as that, when it's set aside. Mm. So what does that open up legally? Surely you can't be like, let's have another 4-year commission of inquiry. So
what does that mean? Into a 20-year-old set of, yeah. of facts.
Yes, exactly. So I do think that that will be interesting. What is the implications of that specifically as well?
Mm. Patrick, do you have any thoughts on commissions of inquiry in general and what happens if they are found to have not done their work properly?
Well, I mean, the commissions of inquiry that have been held, very little has come out of them. And I think in the public mind as well, there's a view that, you know, hundreds of millions of rands are being spent on commissions. But this seems quite an unusual case that an entire commission is overturned like that. But certainly it's another instance of where our courts and our many brave judges have come to the rescue of the state and of the people of South Africa. And we saw this in the apartheid era where really it was the judges, few among them, who protected us from the worst of what the National Party wished to visit upon us in the media, in the courts themselves. And now we're seeing the courts increasingly having to stand up and take a stand against excesses committed by, you know, the administrations of the past 25 years.
Speaking of judges, clearly Edwin Cameron retired this week after 25 years, I think, on the bench, and of which 11 of them on the Constitutional Court.
Yes, almost.
A special session this week. What is his legacy? Is it a legal one? Is it a broader one?
I think Edwin Cameron's legacy is as broad as you can think. There was a very nice, it was quite a beautiful description given yesterday, I think, by Ronald Lamola, our Justice Minister, when he basically said, well, judges' judgments, they live forever. And they when you go and you reference case law, effectively, even if they pass away, when they die one day, they can still speak from the grave through their judgments. And I do think Edwin Cameron's, but his legacy is so much more than that. His absolute activism, firstly as a lawyer, then as a judge, where he went through every single one of the judicial ranks. He was at the SCA. And the one thing that came through very strongly is his humanity through all of that. And if you look at the type of judgments that they've delivered, such as his last one that he delivered yesterday, another one which is quite prominent is the Glenister judgment, which effectively dealt with like the MPA Act and dealt with the Scorpions and the independence of it. It's quite a legacy. And those are just two recent, Glenister is a very old judgment. But yes, his legacy is incredible. But just to add in terms of what you had said about the judiciary, Ronald Lamola, when he spoke yesterday, basically praised the judiciary and said, thank you for saving us from a total collapse during the Zuma years. And if you look at somebody like Edwin Cameron, he has been on the Constitutional Court bench for almost, the entire decade that Jacob Zuma was president. And they warned, he said yesterday, well, we're warning you, when he got in 2008 and 2009, he told his colleagues, I think the first 15 years of the court would have been very easy. The hard years are coming. And he said yesterday, the harder years are now coming. So, yes, quite a legacy, quite a man.
And he said, so that's, we haven't even mentioned his legacy as someone who's lived with HIV since 1981, if I'm not wrong, and was one of the very first high-profile people to come out and say it. I mean, how important has that been in the whole fight against HIV and AIDS?
I think it's been incredible, because him coming out as a high-profile individual like that, even at the time, HIV/AIDS was, you know, if you had one, you know, there was stigma around it. You could even be stoned to death. I think the reason why he came out, one, I just can't remember the name, had been stoned to death because of the fact that they were infected with HIV and AIDS. So that was really powerful of him to come out. It was a powerful statement to make around his activism.
And the fact that he was gay as well, that he was one of the first people as well to openly admit that. So I think that powerful combination, I mean, if you just go onto Twitter and see the tributes that have been given to him, it's quite clear that a very disparate group of people in our society, from the Chief Justice all the way through to activists of all kinds, have lauded him for his courage and also his legal acumen.
So as much a human rights activist as a legal activist. Moving quite quickly onto the National Health Insurance Bill, Warren, which has been gazetted at last after many, many, many years of threats, promises. We've seen Discovery's share price absolutely tank. Why? What sort of impact is just the gazetting, just the bill itself, before we even have the actual National Health Insurance, what impact is it having on the market?
Generally very negative, and across markets, not just talking about listed medical schemes like Discovery, who would be one of the biggest to lose should the current form of NHI pass, because they would lose the ability to administer medical schemes, because in effect you'd have one big pooled medical scheme administered by the state. But we're hearing about the kind of fear that is developing with doctors and other medical practitioners who look at a government that struggles to run basic things well and thinks, as practitioners, will they be able to charge the same rates that they have become accustomed to? So if you look at people like endocrinologists, surgeons, highly skilled and highly paid medical professionals, are they going to want to work under the system? And secondly, what sort of restrictions are going to be put on the demand side from consumers who might have to use services that they might not want to in areas, even earmarked according to areas, like where would you go and get services from a general practitioner? So there are a lot of unintended consequences that have arisen, I think, not only just the financial and whether we can sustain investments that Discovery makes into the practice of administering, keeping people healthy, encouraging them, like the Vitality Program does, to manage their own health proactively, but also on the human resources side, you know, are we going to be able to retain doctors that, yes, we do pay a lot of money for, but it's better than not having them, you know, in a national health insurance.
Patrick Bulger, what consequences, anticipated and unanticipated, are likely to flow from this bill? And taking into account that certainly government and others are saying that universal health care is an absolutely legitimate and important objective, is that what we're going to get?
Well, of course, universal health care is a legitimate objective, and it's health inequality really is kind of it's really the center of what apartheid was all about. The fact that, you know, that richer white people were had access to a better medical care than those without. And that was sort of quite clearly along racial lines. Obviously, 25 years into democracy, that's a little bit blurred. And obviously, you know, it often comes up that members of our ruling party and other people in top positions in government quite happily use private services. I think now the ideological battle has become that much more pitched. So while NHI has been an objective of the ANC for a decade and probably a decade plus, the political playing field is such that to be seen as the ANC not to be pushing NHI really hard opens up that faction of the party, if you like, to attacks from the EFF, for example, from the radical economic transformation wing of the party. So there is a big political prize at play here.
Even though the economic cost, Claudia, I mean, is that what this is about? That this is about the politics within the party, as much as anything else, because it certainly doesn't look like we've got the money to implement it.
Well, if we finally know how much it will cost, it will be great. But given that we don't, that's another story. I do think it's probably a little bit more nuanced than that, than just going saying this is just a factional political battle. I absolutely understand what you're saying in terms of that it opens them up, because there's a lot of within the party, if you look at resolutions taken by the ANC, especially now during the presidency of President Cyril Ramaphosa, whenever there's a conference resolution and they don't act on it, if you look at the nationalization of the Reserve Bank, if you look at land expropriation, to try and implement resolutions it's being used as a factional type driven tool almost. But I do think though, in terms of the NHI, the politics of the NHI absolutely links into what the ANC traditionally stands for and what like the left, for instance, would want. And as lots of people have said, it's a noble thing. But fact of the matter is, it will happen, regardless of who complains about what. And that's the message Zweli Mkhize has given very clearly. But he has also conceded that it won't happen without political will. And if you look at the pilot projects of the NHI, one of the big issues that they did raise is if it doesn't have political will, then...
Is it going to happen? I mean, is it even feasible?
As Claudia says, political will is needed for it to happen. But I doubt there is enough of that because President Cyril Ramaphosa, biggest cheerleader, corporate South Africa, you know, is not behind this. They are not behind this plan. So, you know, it could, he would have to, you know, juggle both. Does he want the investment from corporate South Africa to push to kickstart the economy, or does he want NHI to, you know, to make sure that the ANC members are not easy pickings for the EFF or the Fight Back campaign? So, it's one of those. So I doubt.
And if I may,
You
know, we talk about political will, but. You know, not to harp on an old subject, but the state of our public hospitals is such that you've got to ask yourself, was there no political will there? Has political will been absent for the last 25 years that a woman gives birth to a child standing up in a hospital in Limpopo? Does this political will somehow materialize out of nothing? Haven't we been having political will up to now?
Well, I suppose that's the other thing is that the kind of pushback that this may face won't only come from the private sector, though that it certainly will, but from government employees themselves, surely, Warren. I mean, where is the kind of pushback against this likely to be if it really looks like it's going to happen?
Well, obviously, your upper class, your access private healthcare. But one of the government's very well run, and I haven't evaluated it recently. But one of their great programs was the Government Employees Medical Scheme, which effectively subsidized the purchase of private health insurance. Very well run. And I think it was extended to virtually every government employee. So, of course, it's an issue about trust. And what, you know, has the ANC maybe misread where the majority of the middle class, and certainly the black middle class, views this issue and views access to private health care if they so choose. I don't have the answers to that, but certainly I would suspect that many people appreciate the ability or at least the option to use private medical care and pay for that when they want to.
Speaking of unintended consequences, though, one of the other pieces of legislation in your, which is partly in your sphere as well, Warren, is the, I think it's the National Credit Amendment Act, which has actually all of a sudden just been signed into law by the president, which lets people off their debts for no real reason. Am I misreading it?
It lets certain highly indebted consumers who earn low salaries, 7,500 rand a month, and that have unsecured credit of 50,000 rand, potentially extinguish their debts. So it's been quite interesting because I think the fundamental battleground is the concept of moral hazard. Should we let people extinguish their debts that have incurred debt? And on the other hand, what about where do we punish the banks that have overextended credit? Because you have this kind of balancing act in terms of who bears the consequences. The lender that has lent to... I just ran some numbers, Hillary. Someone earning 7,500 rand a month and servicing debt, unsecured debt of 50,000 rand, is probably paying as much as 25% of their salary to service that debt. To me, that sounds highly indebted. And to me, both from the consumer and the lender, they've equally to blame for that situation where they've got themselves to this position where you have as much debt as that on that type of salary. So I think the battleground between the industry and government is saying, well, hold on, we've got to be careful not to let these people off the hook. The other side of the issue is that if you don't let the regulated sector extend credit to these low-income people, mm-hmm. they move into the informal credit market, mm-hmm. and I can tell you the terms and the rates of that are much more severe than what is gazetted in law.
And T. said so, Business Day's front page lead this week about Capitec cutting its exposure to people earning 7,500 rand or less. You raised the question in Business Day whether this was not actually going to chill credit extension to exactly those people who the Act wants to serve. Do you think that's going to be, I mean, what are the dangers here?
We're already seeing signs of that with Capitec. Capitec is widely known as as a leader in that kind of market in the unsecured lending, particularly for people that earn that much money. So if they're pulling back, so you worry, where would those people get access to credit? I mean, as Warren says, they go to, to machinistas, unregulated. Yes, wow. They go to them and it's a problem. But at the same time though, some lenders have been reckless and there has to be some kind of punishment. If you are going to lend somebody who earns that much money per month and they are not financially literate, and you should bear the blame for doing that as a bank, as a lender, for lending somebody who doesn't know what they're doing because they're just struggling to get some money to make ends meet.
Patrick, I mean, are there unanticipated consequences of this Act going to outweigh any benefits?
Always. I mean, the financial sector, they're going to trim their sails to the new circumstances. But on that, I see there's a bank offering, they offer you a housing loan, a 5 million rand housing loan. Yeah. I mean, really... we're talking about what level of income would a person expect to maintain for the next 20 years. So certainly that element of recklessness is apparent. I mean, I get offered money that I promise I can never pay back. And so, to dangle this sort of carrot in front of poor people.
Yeah.
And of course, people are really pressed. These loans, they're not being taken for capital sort of goods or anything that's going to have sort of lasting value. Yeah. People are surviving really, month to month.
Yeah. My sense of it, Hillary, looking at the bank results, which have all had very low what would be called credit loss ratios. So the amount of loans that they're writing off as a percentage of their total loan book is at almost like historic lows. It's very low. Mm-hmm. So my sense is that the big banks have slowly over a period of years, post the Marikana and that massive strike in the platinum industry, mm-hmm. holding back credit. And you can even see in Capitec's results, their loan book has actually been decreasing year to year recently, mm-hmm. because one, they've been worried about the economy and extending too much credit into some of these markets. And I think it's going to hit more of the kind of secondary lenders, the non-bank, privately owned credit lenders, that are probably the ones that have been pushing the credit limits too hard, because it's certainly not coming from the banks insofar as I've seen from the results.
1 minute to go. Claudia Malevich, we started with law. Let's end with law. Very quickly, the Jiba case. That is now in court again. What are the implications of that? If you can just run us through that very quickly.
So, very quickly, Nomgcobo Jiba was one of the deputy national directors of public prosecutions. There's four of them. She was fired by the president earlier this year. Parliament now has to go through the process, but now she's gone to the High Court in the Western Cape, and she wants to interdict it. A lot of the factions from within the MPA comes from the level of the deputies. And the implication of this is basically Silas Ramayete, one of the other deputies, have retired. Jiba, whilst they fight this, whilst they wait for Parliament to complete it, they effectively won't be able to go and say, let the MPA move on, let's appoint somebody new.
Oh, right. Mm-hmm. So the MPA cannot move on and get itself organised until this is
well,
sorted.
Well, it can, but so you still have to get... It just hampers the process because they need those deputies.
We're going to wrap it there. Thank you very much. Please join us again next week for another edition of Editing Aloud.